Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is Radio Boston. Coming up, Yawkey Way, named for the former Red Sox owner who was infamously slow to embrace racial integration, is no more.
It is a disgrace every time I or any black go into Fenway Park.
Also today, former Newton Mayor Seti Warren drops out of the governor's race, saying the money's just not there to go up against a popular and well-financed Governor Baker.
Decisions to get into races, decisions to get out, they're personal, and people make them for whatever reason makes sense for them, and I wish Seti nothing but the best.
We'll get reaction from the two remaining Democrats. And former White House photographer Pete Souza on 8 years photographing President Obama and witnessing history.
You're there working on behalf of all of us, and it's your job to document for history everything that takes place.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we'll begin today with a question made famous by William Shakespeare. What's in a name? Well, it turns out quite a lot. If the name belongs to a family you've been feuding with, as it was in the Bard's famous play. And it turns out there's also quite a lot in a name if the name is Yawkey in Boston today. Tom Yawkey, who owned the Red Sox for 43 years, died in 1976. The foundation that bears his name has a laudable record of philanthropy and charitable giving. But the baseball team that he ran was slow to integrate, and some have charged that back in his day, Yawkey was racist. So John Henry, the current owner of the Red Sox, has been pushing to rename Yawkey Way, and today he prevailed. The Boston Public Improvement Commission agreed to restore the original name, Jersey Street. WBUR reporter Fred Tice was at the meeting this morning, and he's here in the studio. Hey, Fred.
Hi, Anthony.
So remind us, this is a controversial issue, and Tom Yawkey's controversial legacy is complicated. So remind us a little bit more about that.
Well, for one thing, the Red Sox were famously perhaps the last club to integrate an African-American player onto their roster 12 years after Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier with the Brooklyn Dodgers. And Robinson himself once called Yawkey the most bigoted person in baseball. That came in part because Robinson had a tryout with the Red Sox, but the team never bothered to get back to him, and the rest is history. Robinson signed with the Dodgers.
Right.
At the same time, the Yawkey Foundation has done a lot of good all over Boston. The Yawkey name adorns many local institutions, the Dana-Farber Center for Cancer Care, Boston's Healthcare for the Homeless's Jean Yawkey Place. There's an entire building at Massachusetts General Hospital called the Yawkey Building. And there also, the Yawkey Foundation's also made major investments in Boston's minority communities, funding scholarships.
So now comes this decision to rename Yawkey Way. What was the reaction to the commission's decision today?
So today in the hearing room, silence, right? But this
really?
Is after, yeah, but this is after two very controversial hearings, 4 weeks ago, 6 weeks ago, where lots of people spoke. Today, hardly anybody turned out. I guess they figured they're going to take the vote and that's that. But one of the key people in this whole debate did turn up today. His name is Walter Carrington. He was in charge of the Massachusetts Commission Against Discrimination's investigation of the Red Sox for racial discrimination back in 1959.
I am very happy that after 60 years, after we made the finding of discrimination against the Red Sox, that this whole matter has now been resolved in the sense that Tom Yawkey's name will no longer be on the street, and I and others like me can go to Fenway Park feeling very proud.
Okay, so there's one reaction.
Yeah, and WCV, the TV Channel 5, asked Mayor Walsh about the decision, and here's what he had to say this morning.
I know that a lot of people are talking about this is going to be help us end racism. I think this is not the answer to that. One thing I hope that doesn't happen, I hope the Yawkey Foundation doesn't get caught up in this because they do incredible work in the city of Boston.
Yeah, so it actually sounds like Marty Walsh.
Yeah, I was
Walsh,
just going to say, I thought Walsh was in favor of changing.
Right, you know, to me, he's sounding like he's part of the crowd. He's making the arguments that the Yawkey Foundation and its allies have been making opposing the name change. But it, you know, it's his commission that voted unanimously to change the name. Right?
Right, okay. So what are we hearing from the Yawkey Foundation itself now that the decision has been made?
They had a very long, moving statement, just a part of which I'll share with you here. They said, we have always acknowledged that it is regrettable that the Red Sox were the last Major League Baseball team to integrate. We also realized there were strong feelings in favor of renaming Yawkey Way based on that painful fact and other criticisms about the team's record concerning race and inclusivity. But we also believe that consideration of the whole story of the team's efforts to integrate and the full picture of Tom Yawkey's life more than justified keeping the name Yawkey Way.
All right. So, Fred, as we mentioned, Red Sox owner John Henry officially asked for the name change in February this year. He said that he was, quote, haunted by the name and that it didn't reflect the organization he was building. But there have been some issues still around race for this organization more recently, right?
Sure. For example, recently, I guess it was last year, there was a fan who hurled a racial epithet and peanuts at Adam Jones of the Baltimore Orioles. And that supported the whole narrative that Boston is not a welcoming place to people of color, a narrative born largely in the violent opposition to busing in the 70s.
Right. So, Fred, what does this ruling mean for Yawkey Station on the commuter rail?
So the ruling today was just about that little two-block stretch of Yawkey Way, right? But Governor Baker was asked today about what it means for the commuter rail station, and he said that they will be changing the name of the commuter rail stop, and that's confirmed by a statement from the T we got this afternoon. It says the MBTA will work collaboratively with its city partners to change the station name, ensure consistency and familiarity for T customers, visitors to the area, and for public safety officials. And the T adds also that originally the station was named for Yawkey Way because it was built after the street was called Yawkey Way.
All right. Well, that's WBUR's Fred Tice. He's our political and higher education reporter talking about the end of Yawkey Way. It will be renamed Jersey Street, its original name. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Let's turn now to the big surprise that has shaken up the Democratic gubernatorial primary race. Former Newton Mayor Seti Warren says he's dropping out because he hasn't been able to raise the big money needed to challenge Governor Charlie Baker. Here are the hard facts that Warren considered. The former Newton mayor had a little more than $51,000 in his campaign account. Baker, the highly popular incumbent, has close to $8 million. So Warren told the Boston Globe the challenge was insurmountable. That leaves just two Democrats in the primary race, Jay Gonzalez, the former Secretary of Administration and Finance under Governor Deval Patrick, and Bob Massey, a former Democratic nominee for lieutenant governor. And we're going to speak to both of them in just a few minutes. But first, we turn to WBUR State House reporter Steve Brown, joining us from Beacon Hill. Hi, Steve. Good to have you.
Hi, Anthony.
And with us here in the studio, Politico Massachusetts reporter Lauren Dzinski. Lauren, always good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
So, Steve, let me start with you. What more can you tell us about why Seti Warren decided to pull out?
Money, plain and simple. Warren's lack of it and Charlie Baker's ton of dough. Now, you'd mentioned that Charlie Baker has close to $8 million in the bank, and that's true. But you didn't mention that Baker's running mate, Lieutenant Governor Karen Polito, also has her own $3.5 million. So they run as a team. Combined, you're looking at well over $11 million. for this race. The chairman of the Democratic Party, Gus Bickford, dismisses the money issue, saying that the Democratic candidates will start raising more money once the Dems have their convention in early June. Maybe so, but Baker and Polito will continue to raise more money, and they likely won't have to spend any of it on a primary, whereas Gonzalez and Massey will. The money just puts the governor's office out of reach for any Democrat. Seti Warren knows that, and he got out now.
All right. Well, I want to listen to just a little bit of Seti Warren on the campaign trail earlier this year. He said he was running for governor to tackle what he called the major issue of our time, which he identified as economic inequality. He wanted to hike taxes on the state's richest residents to make investments in things like transportation and education. So here he is speaking at a Democratic caucus in Hull in February. Let's listen to a minute.
We've got to have people who are doing well in this economy contribute more so that we can fully fund K through 12 and add to public education after school enrichment, summer enrichment, early childhood, and free public college lifelong. Those are the kind of investments we need to be making.
So that was Seti Warren speaking in February. He's out of the race now. Lauren, I want to bring you on this. What are your thoughts on Seti Warren's announcement today?
I mean, it's absolutely a surprise. I've been saying that a little bit, but, you know, Seti Warren was making calls to, Democratic state committee members, people who would be supporting him at the state convention. Very recently, he was doing, you know, policy-based, campaign-based tweets from his account. I know that's, you know, kind of anecdotal, but it's an indication that this wasn't exactly a campaign that had been powering down for a long time. And I think it very much took a lot of people by surprise, myself included.
Yeah, Stephen, Warren got into this race pretty early. His top advisors included John Walsh, the former Democratic Party chairman. He had a solid resume, a former mayor, a veteran. How surprised were you by this? I mean, I understand what you said about the money, but how surprised were you?
I was surprised as well. He was in it. I don't think, you know, he probably would say outward, yeah, oh, yeah, I think I can win it. But probably in the back of his mind, he knew the odds were against him and everything. But still, you know, he might want to bring some of these issues to the debate and bring them to Charlie Baker and see if he can get some of them enacted.
Now, Steve, you were at an event with Governor Baker earlier today. What did he have to say about Seti Warren's sudden departure? From the
well, he wished Seti Warren well. He said that the decision to get into or out of a race is personal, and that people make them for whatever makes sense for them. The governor plans on just focusing on his job of being governor. I did ask him, though, if he and his hefty campaign war chest are unbeatable.
There's no such thing in politics as a sure thing, and we all know that. And as I said, I'm going to focus on the job because I think what voters want more than anything out of their elected officials is that they spend more time focusing on the work and a little less time focusing on the noise.
This is sort of what he's been doing all along when it comes to the presidential campaign back 2 years ago, whenever we would ask him about what's going on with the presidential campaign and Donald Trump as a candidate at the time. He would just say, hey, I'm focusing on my day job. I'm just focusing on my day job. And it sounds like he's going to be doing that for the next 6 months.
All right. So, Lauren, this leaves two Democrats in the primary race, Jay Gonzalez and Bob Massey. We're going to hear from them shortly. But in your view, what does this mean for them? What does the race do? What does this departure mean for them?
I mean, this very much kind of clears the field for them. Now this allows both Jay Gonzalez and Bob Massey to kind of run in the respective lanes that they've kind of occupied. Bob Massey is very much kind of seen as the Bernie Sanders in our backyard. You know, he's a very, very progressive candidate and very much kind of aligns with the Bernie Sanders supporters among the Democratic Party. Jay Gonzalez kind of represents a more centrist part of the Democratic Party, you know, and has experience, you know, in Governor Patrick's administration. He has experience in ANF and kind of a more budgety, Democratic Charlie Baker sense. And I think you're really going to kind of see a separation between the two candidates in a way that was harder to see when there were three candidates in the field.
Interesting. So now look, Seti Warren dropped out because he said he couldn't raise the money to compete with Baker's hefty campaign war chest. Won't that be a problem? Steve, I'll come to you on this question. I'll come to you both. I'll start with you, Steve, for Bob Massey and Ray Gonzalez.
Yes, definitely. Jay Gonzalez, definitely, because You know, people are not kicking in money onto these campaigns right now. They might be actually focusing on some other campaigns. Some, you know, some Democrats in around might be saying, hey, you know, we're never going to be able to defeat Charlie Baker. Maybe my money might be better spent maybe out of state, putting it into a congressional race that they might see that they have a chance of flipping.
Yeah. And what about you, Lauren? What do you think? I mean, I know that, and we're going to hear this from the candidates, that too much is being made about polling and money, polling and money, polling and money. I mean, Charlie Baker seems to have the big advantage there, but is too much made out of that?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard because you don't want to overblow the significance of polling and money. And yet, both represent snapshots and metrics of a race at a given point. And the thing about Seti Warren saying that, you know, he couldn't break through fundraising-wise, it's an issue for everyone in the Democratic primary right now. Jay Gonzalez and Bob Massey are also kind of struggling to bring in the type of fundraising dollars, at least that Governor Baker is and that Seti Warren was struggling with. And all three are dealing with a lack of name recognition among voters come November. So that's the thing that I think is kind of raising some people's eyebrows about Seti Warren's departure, is that his situation wasn't necessarily that different from the two other candidates that remain in the race. Now, how things kind of shake up subsequently and what happens after the fact, you know, very much stands to be seen. And of course, there is still time before, you know, the state convention come June, as well as the primary, you know, the first Tuesday of September, as well as November itself. Obviously, things can always change.
Yeah, I mean, there are two ways to look at this, I think. I mean, it's really interesting. On the one hand, as you said, Lauren, lots and lots of time yet to go, and it's sort of silly for anyone to sort of call this race. On the other hand, Seti Warren stepping out of the race for this reason sort of adds to the narrative that Charlie Baker's got all this money and is super popular and really hard to beat.
Absolutely. Right? And that was the other thing that kind of surprised me about the statement that came from Seti Warren, is that he acknowledged that Governor Baker has this astronomical support and this significant fundraising, when he's spent the last year plus saying that Charlie Baker is beatable. So that change and that shift, again, kind of raised my eyebrows and you know, led to the shock that I felt this morning when I saw the news come out.
All right. Well, that's Lauren Dzinski, political reporter and author of The Massachusetts Playbook, and WBUR reporter Steve Brown up at the State House. Thank you both. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you.
Thank you, Anthony.
All right. As promised, we're joined now by the two remaining Democratic candidates for governor. Bob Massey was the 1994 Democratic nominee for lieutenant governor. Welcome, Bob. Good to have you.
Good to be here, Anthony.
Thank you for sitting here patiently listening to us talk about you. And Jay Gonzalez worked in Governor Deval Patrick's administration as the Secretary of Administration and Finance. Jay, thanks for coming in to talk to us.
Thanks for having me.
So let me start. Seti Warren's announcement came as a pretty big surprise, as we heard this morning. Your thoughts? I'll start with you, Jay.
Well, I was surprised as well. I want to say that Seti and Bob Massey and I have spent a lot of good quality time together over the past year on the campaign trail. We've gotten to know each other pretty well, and I like Seti a lot. I appreciate his contributions to this race and some of the issues that he focused on, like income inequality, like you mentioned. And I wish him well in whatever he decides to do next.
Yeah, so Bob, same question to you. I mean, give me your sort of quick comment about Seti Warren dropping
out. I've known Seti Warren for a long time, and he's an honorable and lovely human being, a great friend. And so my first reaction was just sorrow. He's worked very, very hard, and it's hard when you come up against that kind of wall. Then later, you start thinking about what that means for the race. But first of all, I just want to say to my friend Seti, thank you for your hard work.
Yeah. So as we heard, it's all about the money. You guys don't have a whole lot more money than the figures are comparable. I mean, we can get them precise, but aren't you both facing the same issue that drove Seti Warren out of the race?
No.
No, go ahead.
No. I mean, I disagree with the premise of much of the previous discussion, and then Steve Brown's a great reporter, but the idea that this is somehow insurmountable, I mean, then we've basically given up democracy to whoever raises the largest money. Mm. I don't think that's right. I mean, democracy is about votes. And I think right now we're seeing people rising up. They're concerned. The governor said he wants to focus on his job. He's not doing his job. I mean, the WBUR poll showed that on issue after issue, more than 50% say that he has not delivered on housing, on transportation, on the opioid crisis, on health care, on transportation, looking at it statewide. So we really see a failure there. In addition, he's not addressing the future problems, climate change, renewable energy, and all the other things that are coming at us. So, you know, Governor, if you're doing your job, please focus on the issues that people really care about. I also think that we have to, one of us is going to win this primary, and then we go on, and we're going to be joined with Elizabeth Warren, who got 600,000 more votes than Charlie, who raised $45 million last time. So we're looking at a blue wave election, and really right now it's up to the Democratic Party and unenrolled voters to determine who's going to be the nominee.
All right, Jay Gonzalez, same question to you. I mean, this issue about money, it seems, I mean, I take Bob Massey's point that it's about votes, but, you know, in defense of Steve Brown, Steve Brown was sort of saying, this is what Seti Warren said. Warren said it was insurmountable.
Yeah, well, this is one of those rare situations where I agree with Charlie Baker, where he said anything can happen, right? So we don't need to raise $30 million of dark money like Charlie Baker's trying to do. We just need to raise enough to be able to support a strong grassroots campaign and make sure people out there are informed about the choice. And our campaign has a lot of momentum right now. We've got a lot of support from legislators and activists all over the state. A lot of volunteers and others who are out talking to people and knocking on doors. And I feel very good about the strength of our campaign right now and the momentum we have. We've been getting stronger every day. I'm confident we're going to continue to, and we're going to be strong enough in the fall to make sure that people understand this is a choice between a governor who has made no progress on any issue that affects people's lives in any real way, no agenda to do so. He's been terrible about standing up against hate and discrimination, and versus someone who desperately wants to do so, make a difference in people's lives. And I would argue, in my case, has the leadership experience to deliver on it. And I think people are going to choose that.
All right. Well, let me sort of push back a little bit and sort of try to present what Charlie Baker might say if he were here, or some of his supporters.
So
his
support,
if his support, well, we'll get him in here one of these days. But his supporters will say his popularity is the result of his record, working well across party lines, fiscal management, not raising taxes. And in this year's State of the Commonwealth address, Baker takes credit for an economy that has more people working than at any time in state history. Here's a bit of what he said. Wait a minute, just listen.
Our economy has added 180,000 new jobs since we took office. And best of all, the number of people looking for work has dropped in every county over the past 3 years, and in most cases by more than 35%.
So, gentlemen, I mean, isn't that a winning message? I'll go to you, Bob.
No, I don't know what state he's talking about. I've been in 250 communities. I can tell you that people are hurting. They're not, don't have access to housing. They don't have access to health care. And these jobs that he talks about, especially for young people, they're crappy jobs. They are gig economy jobs, independent contractor jobs, no benefits, no real future. That's what people are facing. Minimum wage jobs where you can't, that's not a living wage. We have a real need for economic justice, racial justice in this state. The governor, I think, because he never has had a public town hall. He doesn't hear from people. I think he's just trapped in a little Beacon Hill cocoon, telling himself he's doing a great job. I'd challenge him to come out today and come out and actually listen to people, take open questions. This guy is very, very controlled, controlling his image, not getting that much done.
Jay Gonzalez, we respond, though, to that record of accomplishment, I guess, on the part of the governors.
Yeah, there is no record of accomplishment. And, you know,
but what he said, I mean, talking about the economy adding 180,000 jobs since he took off.
That's what Donald Trump says. And they're both beneficiaries of the work of Barack Obama and Deval Patrick and the investments they made to help our economy grow. Look, his popularity is not a function of what he's doing. It's a function of the fact he hasn't done anything. It's easy to be popular when you don't do anything and you never take a stand and your whole approach to the job is being cautious instead of courageous. We need leadership. He is dragging us backwards. One of the other things he cited in that State of the Commonwealth speech is that we, Massachusetts, were first in the country ranked by U.S. News & World Report. Well, since then, we've dropped to eighth. And we've dropped to eighth because our transportation system is one of the worst in the country. Fiscal stability, one of the worst in the country under Charlie Baker. When I was in charge of the state budget, we had the highest bond rating in state history. Our bond ratings dropped under Charlie Baker. He set us up for a fiscal crisis. Every single issue, as Bob mentioned, that you guys recently polled and asked people, do you think Charlie Baker's doing a good job on the opioid crisis, climate change, transportation system? The majority of people in this state think he is not on every single issue.
Well, they give him high sort of marks overall, but you're right.
Do you know what
the majority think he's doing an okay job or a not, sort of between okay and not so
great. Do
you
know what it is?
Yeah.
It's when people are asked, how do you feel about him? And they say, he's fine. The polling shows no one's passionate about Charlie Baker. And it is because he isn't doing anything. He hasn't done anything to offend anyone. But when you actually ask, how is your life? How's the quality of your transportation system, your education system for your kids? People are not happy about that. And as Bob mentioned, as we're going around the state, there are lots of people who are being left behind, who are facing big challenges, and we need a governor that's going to actually provide leadership and work with a sense of urgency to make a difference on these issues.
Well, you guys are making sort of friendly references to each other, but you guys are also running against each other. So what do you see as the issues that separate you two? I'll start with you, Bob.
Well, we come from different backgrounds. You know, I started many years ago as a minister in the 1980s. I then went to Harvard Business School in order to pursue economic justice. I've done grassroots leadership. I've brought together people who disagreed from business and investors and activists. I've made substantial change. I also worked on climate change for 26 years. I just won the endorsement of 350.org, which is a massive national organization today. So I think, you know, Bernie in your own backyard, that's flattering. I embrace that, but I also go beyond with a deep experience in the economy and social change and structural change. I think that's what people want. They, you know, I don't have Beacon Hill ties. I bring a really fresh perspective and a fresh approach. And I think people are ready to aspire to much greater things and lay out challenges that we can get done. And I believe that's something I have a record of achieving.
Jay, how would you sort of characterize your differences with Bob Massey?
Yeah, I agree. On the issues, I think there are more similarities than differences, but I think it's really about experience. And, you know, I am the only candidate that has leadership experience in state government getting big things done. This is the first time I've run for statewide office. I am not a career politician. But we both have a very progressive, ambitious agenda we want to get through. And when I worked for Governor Patrick as a Secretary of Administration and Finance, I was often his point person for getting a lot of big things through the legislature and working with the legislature and other stakeholders. So it's not going to matter what we all want to do unless we actually deliver on it. And I think I'm best positioned to do that, which is why I think progressive leaders like Senator Jamie Eldridge and Senator Cindy Friedman and a lot of others have endorsed my campaign. I think they see me as best able to deliver on the progressive agenda that we need in this state.
So you're calling yourself a progressive. Do you not buy Lauren Dzinski's idea that Bob Massey is sort of the Bernie in our own backyard and you're the centrist here?
I didn't want to call Lauren out, but I've got a very progressive agenda. It's why I'm getting support not only from some who are more moderate in the Democratic Party, but many who are very progressive, like Senator Jamie Eldridge, who I think all would agree is probably the most progressive senator. I'm offering an ambitious progressive agenda, the leadership experience to deliver on it, and I think that's what we need right now in this state.
All right. Let me come back to the sort of another challenge, and you guys have made reference a couple of times to the WBUR poll, and there was a big challenge in that poll for both of you, and that's around name recognition. I mean, in that poll from March, more than 60% of the voters we talked to had never heard of either of you. Bob Massey, how do you change that?
Well, first of all, we face a political process within the Democratic Party that doesn't really work because it keeps us focused running around to town committees, which, of course, I respect them. It forces us to do chase delegates, do all that stuff. So we are competing primarily within that structure, a structure that I want to change because I think the party needs to open up. Also, I'd like you to poll tomorrow and see what happens after this show and the newspaper and a lot of other things. I've done a lot of interviews today. So this is just going to go up. And as it goes up, people will understand the what we're saying as Democrats. I'd like to say, for me, a progressive is someone who really pursues economic justice and is willing to take on corporate power. And that's something I don't think Jay fully has the experience in doing. But that being said, I think both of our names are going to be more recognized in the weeks ahead. And as we go all the way through the spring and all the way through the summer, I think we're going to see that rise and rise and rise.
Jay, we have less than 30 seconds left. I'll give you the last word here.
So there's a lot of enthusiasm and excitement out there for our campaign. A lot of people who've gotten engaged who believe that we should expect more from our governor than just someone who's all about the status quo, accepts the world the way it exists, and trying to manage it better. We need a governor who's going to aim higher and actually work to make a difference in people's lives. And I believe as this campaign goes on and we get more name recognition and more people understand that choice, we're going to end up taking back the governor's office and actually delivering on that.
All right, gentlemen. Well, that's Jay Gonzalez and Bob Massey, the Democratic candidates for governor. And we'll talk to both of them again next month in our gubernatorial primary debate on May 17th. Gentlemen, thank you for coming in today. We're very grateful.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. If you're buying a house, a home inspection can flag major problems. If you're buying a car, there's a reporting system that can tell you about a vehicle's accident history. But what about if you're shopping for a college education? Every year, students and families shell out tens of thousands of dollars on tuition. How can they tell whether a school is financially stable or if it's about to close? As in the case of two local schools, Wheelock and Mount Ida Colleges, shutting down after this semester. WBUR Edify reporter Carrie Young has this report.
Mount Ida students and parents say they're still reeling from the news that the college won't reopen in the fall.
We certainly were not prepared for the fact that the college itself was in such dire debt.
I just don't get how it got this bad.
I never received any information that they were in such bad financial distress.
That was parent Laurel Collins, student Lacey Perry, and parent Laurie Jurassic, who all say they were blindsided when they heard about the planned shutdown earlier this month, which got me wondering, could anyone have seen this coming?
I think that's a tricky question.
That's Dr. Talani Britton. She teaches higher education economics at Harvard's Graduate School of Education. She says the answer to my question is both a yes and no. Britton explains it's a yes because all for-profit and non-profit private schools are issued what's known as a financial responsibility composite score by the U.S. Department of Education every year.
So essentially it really looks at the financial health of the institutions. It's a single number as opposed to, a financial report that you then have to decode or decipher.
They're publicly posted, and the scores are based on three main factors.
So first is sort of what's called the primary reserve. Essentially what it does is says, can this institution cover its existing expenses? The second component is the equity component,
which basically measures a school's capacity to pay unexpected expenses or even make campus improvements. And the third factor looks at whether the school is operating within its means. And all of that boils down to one number, or score, from -1 to +3.
If you are over 1.5, it means you're financially responsible, you're in the clear.
Scores lower than 1.5 trigger government oversight measures. Mount Ida has been consistently scoring a 1.8, so outside of the official danger zone, despite the school's financial problems.
This score actually doesn't have great predictive power.
Britton adds that on the other side, only 1 in 5 schools that got failing scores in 2011 actually closed by 2017. So why is this tool missing the mark? To find out, I called up Melissa Emery Aris. She investigated this very question for the U.S. Government Accountability Office last year.
Some of the particular issues that we found with it were things like it was no longer reflecting current accounting practices.
It's outdated.
And also, quite frankly, that it's vulnerable to manipulation. There were loopholes. For example, some of them would inflate their scores by taking out large loans and then pay back those loans.
The now defunct Corinthian Colleges was one of the biggest users of this tactic.
We recommended that the Department of Education update this formula.
I reached out to the Department of Education for its response. While no one was available for an interview, the department sent its official response letter to the Government Accountability Office, which said the report didn't show how new accounting standards have made the scores any less reliable, adding the department is planning to establish a committee to consider the possibility. So, what can students and families do to avoid getting stuck in a situation like what many are going through at Mount Ida College? Emery Aris actually recommends they still check out the financial responsibility scores.
Even though this is not the most accurate tool, it is still a useful indicator and can be helpful to students and their families.
So while the scores may not be the most accurate, for right now, they're the best we've got, unless you want to brush up on your corporate accounting skills.
That's WBUR Edify reporter Carrie Young with that report. Stay with us. Coming up, former White House photographer Pete Souza on 8 years of photographing President Obama and witnessing history. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. For 8 years, Pete Souza photographed history. Souza is a Massachusetts native, a BU alum, and served as the chief official White House photographer for President Barack Obama. He also served as an official photographer to President Ronald Reagan. Souza took almost 2 million photos of President Obama, his advisors, and family. Among them, one that shows President Obama bending over so that a 5-year-old African-American boy named Jacob can touch and feel the president's hair. Here's First Lady Michelle Obama talking about that famous photo at a Congressional Black Caucus event back in 2012.
And after touching my husband's head, the little boy exclaimed, "Yes, it does feel the same." Now, every couple of weeks, the White House photographers change out all the photos in the West Wing, except for that one.
Except for that one, which is called Hair Like Mine. And it's one of the first pictures in Pete Souza's book, Obama, An Intimate Portrait. My colleague, Meghna Chakrabarty, spoke to Pete Souza about his work, beginning with that photo, which might be the most iconic photograph of the Obama era.
Pete, can you tell us the story of how you saw that moment and how you captured that moment?
Well, I think I can't ever argue with the First Lady. She pretty much told it the way it was. But so Jacob Philadelphia, his dad was a national security staff person, non-political. And when he was receiving his next foreign post, the president invited the family into the Oval Office for a snapshot standing in front of the desk. I think the picture resonates for a couple of reasons. One, that you have this 5-year-old kid, African-American kid, touching the head of the President of the United States who looks like him. You know, that's one. But two, I think it tells you something about Barack Obama, even though he was President of the United States, that at the behest of a 5-year-old kid, he would go ahead and bend over and let this kid touch his head.
Now, it looks like you were standing behind one of the couches in the Oval Office when you took that picture.
I can't remember exactly where I was standing, and the composition of the photo is not that great. Fortunately, I was in a position where you could clearly see Jacob's eyes.
Exactly.
And you can clearly see his hand touching the president's head. You know, it was a lucky moment in a lot of ways. And I only have one frame. I mean, it happened so fast, I clicked the camera and it was gone. The moment was gone.
So I want to ask you, you know, you had a unique view of 8 years of the White House. But through it all, and the president himself writes about this in the intro to your book, you had to make yourself invisible in documenting these pictures. I mean, how did you do that, especially when you were in, I don't know, the Situation Room, which is like kind of a small place? How did you get the images that you needed but became invisible in the act of doing so?
I mean, I think I just have this knack. I like to say I used a small footprint, meaning I used very quiet cameras. I didn't carry a lot of gear with me. I didn't use a flash or a motor drive. And I would move around quietly and not, you know, I tried never to interrupt a meeting. My job was an observer. I was not there to be a participant.
But on the other hand, you also write how, you know, you spent so much time with President Obama that you got to know him. And I'm just wondering if there are aspects of him that you got to know in the way, obviously, in the way that the rest of us in America didn't.
Yeah, I mean, I think because we shared so much time together, you know, he would often chat with me in between meetings or beginning of the day or the end of the day. And I knew the kind of day he had just had. I could recognize that because I had been there throughout the day. He's not a different person. He's what we all think of him. That's who he is.
Hmm. Well, I want to talk about a couple of other photographs that are in the book. And an early one, just the end of January 2009, where he's, you know, he and the Obama administration is trying to grapple with the financial crisis. And yeah, it's a photo of Obama leaning back in his chair with his head on the top of the headrest. And he's just kind of looking up as if to say, like, how are we going to keep the American financial system from falling apart?
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of tense meetings at the, you know, those first couple of years trying to figure out what levers needed to be pushed to try to right the economy. I mean, people forget, you know, what bad shape we were in. In this particular frame that you refer to, someone at the table had just come up with an idea or had made a statement, and he was sort of taking it in.
He does look deeply contemplative. But this photograph makes me think, you know, he does seem rather heroic in virtually every photograph. And I'm wondering, there had to have been times, maybe many, many times, where, you know, there was this Barack Obama was feeling a sense of deep frustration or anger or, you know, I don't know, when he's dealing with the fallout of a bad decision that he'd made. I'm not seeing very many of those pictures in
there. I think if you look carefully, they're there. In terms of struggling, you know, with the economy, there's pictures that I made that were used in attack ads out of context during the presidential campaign, the reelection campaign. So I take issue with what you say. I mean, there's a picture in there of him learning about, you know, the terrible tragedy at Benghazi. There's a picture of him reacting to the news about Newtown. I don't think either one of those pictures are flattering. Mm-hmm. I think they're honest and authentic.
So here's why I asked the question, Pete, because I'm curious about what you felt your mission was. What was your charge in these 8 years? Was it a journalistic one or something else?
Let me put it this way. I photographed him for almost 4 years as a photojournalist for the Chicago Tribune. The day that I walked into the White House to become his White House photographer, I didn't suddenly start taking pictures in a different way. Now, the difference is that my job, my primary mission as White House photographer, was to document his presidency for history. Mm-hmm. That's it. Now, in terms of this book, this was my book. This was not his book. This is my version of what I saw.
Well, I have to say, one of the series of photographs that I particularly like, and it's from July 21st, 2011, when the government was on the brink of hitting the debt ceiling, right? And so you've got photographs of Nancy Pelosi sort of pointing her finger at Obama and Joe Biden and Barack Obama taking a walk afterwards. And then you know, they're sitting around in their shirt sleeves later, like on the phone, basically trying to, I guess, work really hard to be sure that they get all the votes they need to keep the government running. And those are the ones I particularly enjoy, right? Because you get to see how the president engaged with key members of the government and sort of the work that went into being president of the United States. I really like that series of photographs as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the challenges I had is so much happened in 8 years, and I couldn't do a 2,000-page book. So I had to make, you know, some choices. But I was trying to give people a sense of what it was like when these stressful things were taking place.
Yeah, another one of those iconic photographs, I think, people will remember with just a little bit of description, is from May 1st, 2011 in the Situation Room. And it's the photograph where all of the national security advisors, there's Joe Biden, there's the president, there's then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, sitting around watching the taking out of Osama bin Laden. We're watching with them this very difficult decision that the president had to make playing out. Can you tell us what that was like?
Interesting to me is you've got, as you say, all the most powerful people in the federal government in that room. They are essentially powerless. In the days and weeks before, they had made this decision to launch this raid. But now there's nothing they can do to affect the outcome. And for 40 minutes, we were in that room. And it was as tense a situation as I've, you know, was ever in those 8 years. People were just glued to what was taking place. They didn't know, you know, what the outcome was going to be. This could have gone really badly, and I think that's why you see the tension and anxiety in their faces.
What was it like for you in those moments?
This was one of the only times in the Situation Room where there was not a lot of conversation going on. When no one is talking and everyone is just listening and watching, then I'm trying to be as quiet as possible. I don't want people to notice that I'm even there. I mean, one of the things that Hillary said when, for whatever reason, somebody tried to make a controversy that she had her hand over her face, is she said to someone, well, I didn't even know the White House photographer was there. And I was like, yay, because that means I was doing my job.
Well, so given the sensitivity of so much that you witnessed, having that much access to the Obama White House, Pete, were there ever any moments where you were actually asked to leave the room for national security reasons?
Not that I can recall, but one of the examples I tell people is in 2016, I guess, we opened relations, diplomatic relations with Cuba. Well, I had been in meetings for a year where they were discussing this, and I couldn't talk about it even for the captions for our archive. I gave incomplete information because I couldn't let anybody else on my staff know what people were talking about. And so, you know, that was just part of the job.
Yeah. How did the experience of those 8 years change you? What did it mean to you?
Well, I'll tell you what it meant to me. It meant that for 8 years I gave up a lot of my personal life. My family sacrificed a lot, but I felt in order to do this job the right way, I needed to always be there. The one thing, and I could say this about the Reagan administration too, is that I wish people would realize, and I can only speak of these two administrations, Reagan and Obama, there's a lot of really good people that are trying to do the right thing. And oftentimes, the only time you'd ever hear about them is if they, you know, screwed up. I saw so many people that public service was their middle name.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so proud to have been a part of that, to have watched this, to have photographed these people. Did they occasionally make mistakes? Well, of course, we're human, right? That's what I came away with from especially these last 8 years.
Yeah. So we talked about one of the first pictures in the book. The last picture in the book is him in the helicopter flying away from the White House after the Trump administration comes in. Can you tell us about that moment?
This was right after the new president was sworn in at the Capitol. The tradition has always been that the outgoing president boards the helicopter on the east side of the Capitol and flies to Joint Base Andrews, and they have one last trip on Air Force One. And the pilot, instead of taking the direct route to Andrews Air Force Base, made a side swing by the White House. So this is a picture of him, President Obama, looking out the window as we pass over the White House. And he said out loud, presumably to Michelle, "We used to live there," which sort of, you know, there was my heart sank a little bit when he said those words.
Mm-hmm. Well, is this the same photo that is the first Instagram photo that you put up?
I believe it is.
Yeah.
So at noon on January 20th, 2017, I became a private citizen and opened a personal Instagram account. And this was the first picture. I think it was the first picture I posted. I'd have to go back and look. I remember what my caption was, though. My caption was farewell. That was it. I thought that I didn't need to say anything else besides that.
Looking back, Pete, is there a moment that you shared with President Obama or a conversation that you had with him? I don't know, maybe when just the two of you were in the Oval Office that you keep coming back to?
There's a few, for sure. I tend to not, repeat those because I'll let him write his book. But I think one that I think is okay to say publicly is after Congress passed the Affordable Care Act, we were alone in the Oval Office. He was about to make some thank you calls. And he said something to me like, you know, the good days are never really as good as you think they are, and the bad days are never really as bad as you think they are. And I looked at him and I said, yeah, but today's a pretty damn good day. And he sort of repeated the words, today's a good day. I think that was the happiest day he had, even more so than, you know, the day he was elected president. And I think he said this publicly. He said, you win elections with the hopes of getting things done. And on that particular day, they got some stuff done. And I think he was proud of that.
That's Pete Souza, former chief White House photographer in the Obama administration, speaking with my colleague Meghna Chakrabarty. His new book is Obama, An Intimate Portrait, and he'll be talking about it tonight at a Harvard Bookstore event at the Back Bay Event Center. You can find more information about the book, about tonight's event, and see some of the photos at our website, radioboston.org. That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Satorik, with help from Zoe Mitchell, Cassandra Sunt, and Susie Tapson. Tim Skog is our technical director. Renee Marchando engineered our program today. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.